From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing on.
BuzzFeed published a dossier full of unsubstantiated claims about Donald Trump and Russia, which led Trump to start his first press conference in months with a rant against fake news. Trump's cabinet nominees have had a rocky start in hearings. The Senate took the first step toward repealing Obamacare, and President Obama gave his farewell address. Welcome to a busy week on Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic, is our special guest. Welcome, everybody. So I guess let's start with the dossier. First, CNN had reported that Barack Obama and Donald Trump had been briefed on the existence of this dossier, alleging that the Russian government has compromising material they could use to blackmail Donald Trump. The 35-page document produced by a private research firm retained by campaigns that were hoping to beat Trump had been circulating in Washington for weeks, and on Tuesday, BuzzFeed just published it in its entirety, even though they said they were not able to verify any of the claims in the document. There are some claims about Trump's financial dealings and claims about contacts between his campaign and the Russian government, though notably, Trump's lawyer has convincingly argued that he could not have been in Prague for a secret meeting with the Russians at the time the document alleges that he was. The report also contains a graphic sexual claim about Trump, which I wouldn't bring up except that he rebutted it at his press conference by saying he's too much of a germaphobe for it to be true. So this is 2017, and this is the reality we're living in. Trump is furious, and honestly, I think he has grounds to be furious. So first, does anyone want to stick up for the editorial decision BuzzFeed made that sort of drove the weekend news?
I don't. I think in an era when trust in the media is already in the gutter, this does absolutely nothing to help. And you saw Trump play that out at the press conference. I also, you know, is it acceptable to publish rumor and innuendo? Tell me I'm wrong. BuzzFeed said they could not verify, yet they still published. And to me, that is a kind of breach of trust.
Yeah. David, I think you can't justify it because when you read the dossier, what you also see is it is on its face pretty implausible as actual information, actual intelligence material. The fact of the dossier's existence and the fact of the briefing, that's real news. But you read this dossier and you think it's too novelistic. It just doesn't read right. And so, as if you're in the business of publishing things that you have good reason to believe are true, if you have something that looks probably false, you don't publish it.
Rich, your magazine published a piece this week pushing a theory that this document is some sort of triple cross, that maybe this document or the claims in the document were planted by the Russians to foment further discontent between Donald Trump and his domestic political opponents, that the claims in the document aren't true, but that the Russians wanted them out there anyway because they are untrue, because they would make Donald Trump upset at the press. That seems too wheels within wheels to me, right?
Yeah, we're in the land of mirrors with that. Look, I think Katrina's point is an important one. BuzzFeed tried to confirm this. And couldn't, and then published it anyway. And to David's point on the implausibility, I mean, the idea that the Russians 8 years ago had the incredible foresight to recruit Donald Trump and to use him to spy against Russian oligarchs in the United States. And then I have to say, on the most lurid allegation, Trump's germaphobe defense, coupled with his very persuasive-sounding awareness of your vulnerabilities in foreign hotel rooms, seemed pretty credible to me. But this was really, I think, it was a gift to him. He's in an ongoing war with the press. This was the press leading with its chin and allowed him at the press conference to elide the difference between CNN and BuzzFeed. Now, there are questions whether the CNN report was strictly accurate, but it was undoubtedly news that the intelligence agencies had summarized this dossier or some version of it in two pages and brought it to a briefing with Donald Trump.
But let's step back from the media angle here, because we were talking earlier. Why did the U.S. intelligence agencies make these documents newsworthy by including a summary of them in a top secret briefing given to Barack Obama and Trump last week? That elevated them, that made them seem newsworthy. There is You were talking about a piece in the National Review by David Satter, a longtime veteran correspondent who's lived in Moscow off and on. Inside Moscow, there is a view among analysts, people who followed this compromat for many years, that perhaps it's the intelligence agencies, divisions within in the intelligence agency, the so-called deep state, rising up to challenge Trump before he takes office, to cripple him in a way from taking actions that would be contrary to their interests. There's no one intelligence community. We've learned many times there's 17. Should there be 17? Has it grown too much post 9/11 without accountability? Those are issues that I trust will be engaged if we, as we move forward. But I agree with Rich on the media thing. I think it gave Trump wide open terrain to do his thing.
I'm not sure that this actually worked out to Trump's benefit. I think BuzzFeed did something it shouldn't have done. I think they deserve criticism for it. But I think this actually hurts Trump in two ways. Mm-hmm. One is that as he comes into office, I think it makes it somewhat harder for him to use a free hand on Russia. If Trump lifts sanctions on Russia, people will look at this report and be inclined to believe at least some of the claims in the report, because the action will be consistent with the allegation in the report. And then the other thing, I don't want to talk about it too much, but the specific weird sexual allegation. There was a great piece in New York Magazine about how Maureen O'Connor called this what's called a wabi-sabi rumor, which is basically a story that we all know is false, but that is all the more tempting and appealing and amusing because of its falseness. And, you know, you see the jokes that were made on Twitter this week, and I think this is a story that's likely to stick to Donald Trump and have people laughing at him, even if people know that the story is made up and implausible.
But I think you're I think you're right, and just briefly, but that this and other factors in the last days work to cripple Trump from taking on a different kind of Russia policy, lifting sanctions, et cetera.
David, what were you going to say?
Well, the very scary possibility, because he is a shrewd and wily person, is that Trump, that this inspires Trump to realize, I have to go cripple the intelligence agencies. I do have to fire people from the CIA, because there is just too much damaging stuff about him. Whatever the nature of his relationship with Russia, it is improper. Whatever the exact nature of his national security advisor's relationship with Russia, it's super improper. He took money from a propaganda arm of the Russian state. A national security advisor should not be doing that. The conflict of interest material, again, we don't know how enormous it is, but it's beyond conflict. Conflicts of interest are warning signs, are guardrails against improper financial activities. Trump is deeply steeped in improper financial activities, and his family is doing more of them every day. So Trump has an inescapable, irrepressible conflict with every law enforcement and national security agency of the U.S. government, because he is so often in the wrong, and he needs their
support. But I would agree with that, except I'd expand it beyond Russia. It's not just Russia. I mean, we're fixated on Russia for a lot of reasons, but on China, on the Emirates, and, you know, to get to the substance of the press conference, he had all these legal folders and he had his lawyer from the global law firm. But what in essence he did was not divest into a blind trust, say his sons will handle it. I mean, it's just farcical.
This was this amazing thing where they brought out these giant stacks of paper and were like, look how long all the legal agreements are for the hands-off and how we're going to protect against conflicts of interest. And they wouldn't let anybody read any of the documents. For all we know, they were full of blank paper.
Yeah, it was a little bit like Trump steaks from that
yes,
Florida
exactly.
Election night press conference. On Russia, I think, Josh, we talked about this last week, the simplest explanation and the one I believe until there's actual evidence of something else is that he thinks Vladimir Putin has been nice to him, and he's going to be nice to Vladimir Putin, and his attitude is the same as the last two new incoming presidents, which is that he has some magic key to getting along with Vladimir Putin. And in terms of his policy, I think if he really wants to lift sanctions on Russia, he's going to go ahead and do it anyway, and this dossier isn't going to stop it.
All I would say is I do think our media have a tendency to personalize everything. We're talking about national interests here, the United States and Russia. And I would argue what is in the United States' national interest is to have a working relationship, not a friendship, a working relationship with Russia. In order, I would say the first thing to do is de-escalate a deepening, dangerous nuclear arms race. Former Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration, William Perry, has become a kind of evangelist on this. But, you know, I think, and we disagree, but I think You need a partnership to combat terrorism, certainly on de-escalating the nuclear arms race, maintaining an Iran deal, which I think is the best we got. So I think in those instances, it's not about Vlad and Donald. It's about the security interests of the United States.
No, not to be pedantic, but I think we have to make sure always to use the phrase state interests, not national interest. The national interest of Russia is to disarm, democratize, and join the European Union.
State interest.
Become a normal country. The state interest of this band of hijackers who have taken over the Russian state and who threaten the Russian people and who threaten their neighbors in Europe and who have had a lot of improper contacts with this, the next administration of the United States.
I would simply make the case that if we want Ukraine to be free and whole, there should be some kind of understanding it doesn't join NATO, but it needs to be, and I'm quoting someone I don't usually quote, Henry Kissinger in 2013 argued, Ukraine needs to be a bridge between East and West. It needs to be part of both if it's going to survive as an economically viable democratic country. Russia needs to withdraw those little green men. There needs to be security guarantees for Ukraine. And if there's a working relationship instead of treating Russia as an enemy, I think we can move forward.
Well, so given all these things on the chessboard, what do we make of Rex Tillerson's hearing this week where he was asked about a lot of these issues, didn't really have answers on a lot of the issues, repeatedly went to this line, basically, I don't have a security clearance yet. I can't answer that question until I review the classified material, including on things like whether the president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, whether his sort of lawless war on drugs where the police are just going around killing people in the streets. It was an example of a thing that Tillerson basically said, well, I'm not in a position to comment on yet. So does that give us confidence as all of these problems arise around the world that Trump is going to have a team in place to deal with that?
Well, he's an impressive man, but he doesn't know much. And this is where it pays actually to be a policy professional. And I don't think it was a devastating performance, but it was an underwhelming one. And perhaps the most extraordinary thing that came out of that hearing is that Rex Tillerson has not talked to Donald Trump about Russia, which goes to a point that David has made in the past. The guy we know is talking to Donald Trump about Russia is General Michael Flynn, who is not in a Senate confirmable position, so we'll never hear from him. Now, Rubio is quite tough on Tillerson. I think making the standard, asking a presumptive Secretary of State whether Putin is a war criminal, there is no presumptive Secretary of State who's going to answer yes to that question, yeah. Maybe in the Lindsey Graham administration, but in no other.
McCain.
But I just doubt that Rubio will ultimately block him. It would just be a thermonuclear act in congressional Republican Trump.
But so, what
relations.
Was the point? Doesn't Rubio again look craven and weak if he does this show of very aggressively questioning Tillerson? The questioning was impressive from Rubio. He really got him on the ropes. But if he does this,
let me submit to you based on years of record that maybe it just wasn't very well thought through.
I will say though, what's interesting is Obama used to always talk about pulling together a team of rivals in his cabinet. But based on Mattis's testimony, I mean, he has to be confirmed. Flynn doesn't.
But this is James Mattis,
Marine General, Secretary of Defense. There's a real range of views on this question we're talking about Russia or on the Iran deal or on torture or on the Muslim registry. So it's kind of who's talking to whom? I mean, you're right. It sounds like Donald Trump has probably given Tillerson a once-over, liked how he looked, which we know is a case, and moved on.
David, what did you make of it?
Nothing is more normal in a Republican administration to have conflict between commerce-first-minded cabinet secretaries and security-first-minded national secretaries. Now, this is true in every administration. They're then coordinated by the White House and the National Security Council. And the fundamental grammar of the incoming administration is, look, this is a reasonably normal cabinet. A little excessive. I mean, normally it's one billionaire to a cabinet, not half a dozen. normally you do try to have, you know, a woman in one of the key cabinet posts and maybe somebody who, you know, they're not all white. But still, I mean, relatively normal, relatively accomplished people. But the problem is the coordinating institutions are so weak. You have a national security advisor who could not be more improper for the job. You have a chief of staff who is a man of great goodwill, but has never served in government, coordinating the entire U.S. government. You have the most ideological OMB chief ever to hold that position. So at every point, it's not like these giant bureaucracies that the Defense Department and the Treasury are going to stop moving if they're not coordinated. But this is going to be like some Frankenstein monster government where the limbs move, but the central coordinating brain doesn't really properly control
but
them.
Within
and
each
often
happy-
has an agenda of its own that's often very ideological or very dangerous or very foreign contaminated.
But I would say within each cabinet position, you have those leading those like a wrecking crew. They want to dismantle the very core. I think of Jeff Sessions at a time when we need to protect voting rights evermore. Sessions would take America back to an era when the government was on the wrong side of civil rights. You have a Pruitt who wants to dismantle the EPA. You have a Price who wants to dismantle the already fragile safety net of health care we have. So it's a wrecking crew.
Well, let us know what you think about the Frankenstein's monster government on our Facebook page or message our Twitter account. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, Obamacare. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina VandenHeuvel of The Nation magazine. And David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic, is also with us. So around 1:30 in the morning on Thursday, the Senate voted for a budget resolution that starts the ball rolling on a repeal of much of Obamacare. The repeal would occur through the budget process. That means it can get through the Senate with a simple majority of 50 Republicans and the vice president, no Democrats required. On the other hand, it means the repeal can only address the parts of Obamacare that directly affect taxes and spending. It won't be possible to repeal most of the important insurance regulations that are part of Obamacare. So this seems to leave us roughly where we were a few weeks ago. At President-elect Trump's urging, Republicans are moving speedily towards some sort of repeal. The resolution that the Senate passed sets a deadline of January 27th to pass legislation, though Senator Bob Corker, who wanted a delay, has been told that deadline is flexible. Trump also said repeal and replace should occur near simultaneously, ideally within hours. The problem here is that the GOP is nowhere near to settling on what that replacement would be and how they would get it through Congress. Now, Rich, you said last week you wanted more clarity from President-elect Trump on what to do here. It doesn't seem like we've gotten that, have we?
I think we've gotten a little more because he's emphasized repeatedly now that he wants replace to be part of repeal. And there are indications of movement in that direction from various top Republicans on Capitol Hill. The problem is, one, procedural, because the reconciliation process allows you to do this with 50 votes. It does limit you to fiscal things with fiscal consequences, and it's really the regulation that's the heart of this thing. And two, just the lack of a consensus among Republicans and folks on the right about what the replace would be or even whether you should do a replacement. There will be conservative groups on the outside saying any sort of replacement constitutes a new entitlement and they shouldn't do it. So it's the partial repeal that is the common denominator here. That's the easiest thing to do. And perhaps that's still where they're heading, but I think that'd be a mistake.
Well, but it was Trump said two things. He said they should be done close to simultaneously,
right.
But he also said that it should be done very quickly, that he didn't want to have to wait months in order to do it. And sort of it seems to me that you can have one of those things,
right.
But you can't have both. If they're going to do them simultaneously, it's going to take them a few months to write the thing. I don't know. David, can you see a strategy here? It feels to me like Republicans, you know, they just committed over and over to repealing and that they want that achievement right away. It seems to me like they're going to get to the point where they vote for the repeal and there's no replace thing to pass. And then what are they going to do? Are they going to just send up the repeal?
I see a communication strategy, but not a legislative strategy and not a policy strategy. They are trapped here because this has become such a powerful shibboleth for so many Republicans. They can't break faith on this. If they do, the legislative majority will be crippled from the start. And yet the voters who elected the Trump presidency are people who will be hurt if the Affordable Care Act goes away. Donald Trump, I think, at some level knows that. I mean, he depends on a different coalition of voters in different states from the Republican congressional majority. So they are looking for things to say. They don't know what to do, and they don't know how to pass it. And I assume that when things like that come into play, what you eventually do is you come up with a communications victory joined to a legislative and policy retreat.
No, David is right that a repeal will hurt Trump voters. How that is messaged is important because you could see attention diverted. You're already seeing in terms of divisions, I think today several Republican governments who have reaped the benefits of Obamacare have come out very concerned about the rollback of Medicaid. I think you will see Vice President Pence, who played a key role in Indiana on beginning to block grant Medicaid, try that. So if you begin moving Medicaid, then you turn to Medicare. And I think the Democrats, who, let's be honest, I don't think President Obama did a great job in really messaging and selling Obamacare over these last few years. Rich and I were talking. I mean, he went up to Capitol Hill the other day to defend it, but the fight for it was when he left to Congress. Now, I think the fight is on not President Obama leading it, but Democrats are going to hold rallies on January 15th, Bernie Sanders and others, and argue that this is the first step to rolling back what has really reshaped America slowly, though the constituency hasn't been fully formed. It takes a while, but the fight is on.
Well, so we saw Barack Obama give his farewell speech this week. Where does this leave his legacy, that it's sort of in the hands of Republicans who have said that they're going to repeal it and maybe that they will find that that's politically or procedurally impossible, but they clearly intend to do something significant to it? It's an awkward position for him, right, that this is his sort of one really big lasting achievement and it's in their hands.
It's awkward across the front. I mean, the election was a repudiation in some way. I think that the fight goes on, though. I mean, it's unclear, listening to Rich, to David, how far Republicans will get. I mean, I think there is a trap. And Donald Trump left his White House meeting saying that he was standing for pre-existing coverage of pre-existing conditions and for kids to stay on their parents' plan till they're 26. So I think Republicans should be worried on a number of fronts. You got governors worried about their hide. You got a president who's capricious, to say the least, who might pull the rug out from under the congressional legislators.
But to underline Josh's point, the investment and the political capital that was spent on this law by Democrats, I mean, they gave up the House for this. It's been a millstone around their necks in multiple elections now. And now there's a chance that it could disappear and all that could have been for naught.
Well, there is a view, I don't fully agree with it among progressives, that, you know, in this kind of blank slate moment, you refight the fight for Medicare for all, and you begin to make that public option was pulled too quickly to go back to all of these fights. But, you know, Obamacare was Mitt Romney, was a Heritage Foundation plan cleaned up by Mitt Romney in Massachusetts. So I think it's in an early stage, but I do think whoever said Republicans are trapped, they spent how much taxpayer money? 60 votes to repeal and replace, and now they got to do it. They got to show something. It's not just talking the talk.
I think there's actually a funny symmetry, Katrina, with Democrats, you know, the increasing rhetorical commitment that I think Democrats are very likely to make over the next few years to Obamacare, to Medicare for all, and right. The idea that we have to move to single payer. And I think, as with Republicans, you know, it sounded good to a base, and then there's a thing when you have to legislate it that becomes the impossible problem. For the left, with Medicare for all, it's that the expense of it is that you would probably need a new payroll tax in the space of
financial transaction tax.
I don't think you can raise enough money with a financial transaction tax.
You begin
with that.
That gives you more running room than just moving quickly to a payroll tax.
Right, but I mean, the Sanders plan was based on a payroll tax between 8% and 9%, and the people who looked at it said that it didn't raise enough money. I think that, I mean, we saw this in Vermont, where Vermont's own legislature tried to do a single payer plan. They always end up choking on the cost. And so I think sort of where we are on healthcare that nobody really likes, we ended up here for a reason, because all the ways to move away from it are more awful than staying where you are. And I think that's why Republicans are likely to muddle through to something that is in many ways similar to Obamacare. I think it's going to be more than a cosmetic shift, but it's not going to be a sea change away from the idea that you subsidize people's private insurance.
Yeah, but if they cut the subsidies on the rich, if they cut the taxes on the rich, roll back a lot of health care protection, the economy goes south, I think the Republicans have a problem.
David.
Josh, can I go back to the first sentence with which you introduced the prior question about President Obama's legacy?
Yes.
I think with this president, we're not going to be thinking in legacy terms. I think he's going to continue to be an active player in a way. I mean, I'm sure there are precedents for this, but no president in my lifetime has done such a thing. I don't think he's going to go off and, like Bill Clinton, try to make a post-Soviet-style personal fortune. I mean, he'll sign a book contract and put money in the bank and make himself financially secure. But I don't think he's motivated by that kind of lust for money that motivated the Clinton family that did them so much harm in this last election. I think he's going to emerge as the leader of the opposition. And that's going to be especially true because the Democratic Party is going to want to go so suicidally to the left, and not just right. embrace Medicare for all, but no. I mean, they keep waving those Mexican flags at their demonstrations. Why do they do that? I don't understand it, but they keep doing it, or somebody keeps
doing it. I agree with you that President Obama is not going to exit the building, particularly in light of the election results. You already see that he's going to work with former Attorney General Holder on redistricting, which is very interesting to me because part of his legacy is also a Democratic Party that's in shambles in the states. I mean, lost enormous number of gubernatorial positions, state legislatures. I agree with you, he will be a pole in the Democratic Party, but I disagree with you. I think there is an ascendant progressive wing. It is no longer the Clinton terrain of the Democratic leadership class, or as someone said, Democrat leisure class. I think there will be a struggle for the future, and Obama is certainly going to be a player. And how many presidents, I think Woodrow Wilson was the last, remain in Washington, which is a player in and of itself?
Unfortunately, I have to cut it there. It's time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Friends of free speech are understandably alarmed every time Donald Trump talks about tightening the libel laws. But a real-world example of what Trump is talking about is playing out in climate scientist Michael Mann's suit against my publication. Mann is objecting to hyperbolic, polemical expression of the sort the Supreme Court has repeatedly protected on First Amendment grounds. And if he prevails, First Amendment law will effectively shift in a more restrictive direction without Donald Trump having to lift a finger.
David Frum.
The final numbers are in, and Germany received 280,000 asylum seekers in 2016. That's an astonishing number. It's almost triple what it took in 2013, but it's down by two-thirds from the peak in 2015. The crackdown on migration flows into Europe is beginning to have effect, and it is indispensable to saving moderate, non-Putinist governments across the continent.
Katrina VandenHeuvel.
So New York State's Attorney General Eric Schneiderman likes to say, when they go low, we go local. And in light of the fact we were talking about possible repeal of Affordable Care Act, one of its key tenets was free access to every FDA-approved method of birth control that can be prescribed by a healthcare provider. And in the possibility of that being repealed, Schneiderman introduced just the other day legislation to keep birth control free. And kudos. And millions of women and families, I think, should welcome that. And we're going to see a lot of attempts in states to maintain the humanizing reforms like these.
For my rant, one of the cabinet nominees up for confirmation this week was Dr. Ben Carson, who's been nominated for some reason to lead the Department of Housing and Urban Development, even though he has no apparent relevant expertise related to housing or urban development. There was an amusing gaffe during his hearing in which Senator Elizabeth Warren asked that he assure the committee that not $1 would go to benefit either the president-elect or his family. Carson replied, "It will not be my intention to do anything to benefit any American." Now, obviously, he was just misspeaking, but I think this does reflect a broader issue, which is that HUD does some important things, and it's not at all clear that there's going to be stewardship of those things under Ben Carson. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Katrina VandenHeuvel, and David Frum. Laura Dimillion produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Let's go.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.